Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Lynn Gurry returns with part two of her excellent reading of Escaping the Matrix. I hope you'll stay tuned. Let me start off by putting the Matrix in context and summarizing last week's part of the story. The Matrix was a fairly bad movie, in mine humble opinion, released in 1999. Keanu Reeves played the 20-something guy, Neo, who starts exploring how the real world really works. In fact, I forget how the real world actually does work in the movie, but it involves a lot of darkness and repression and violence. Just like ours. In the movie, very few people have any inkling of what the real world is really like. People are actually held in suspended animation and fed a steady stream of artificial perceptions and artificial experiences. In this phony artificial world, in the world of the Matrix, things go pretty smoothly and the population stays pretty content. As I said, this movie is not a landmark of cinematic art, but its central trope is excellent, the contrast of illusion versus reality, the false impression of popular freedom and power versus the actual system's control of the unaware, unwitting people. This idea goes way back, most famously to a section of Plato's Republic. Reality versus illusion, and which is which? It's a powerful trope. It rings true to many of our own experiences. And we find it in literature and rhetoric and art century after century. For example, today the extreme right wing likes to describe the mass of Americans as sheeple. Sheep people. Totally unaware of how they are being deceived and manipulated, brainwashed by the evil foes of individual freedom. In fact, I think the right wing is more or less correct. The extreme right and I just disagree about who the evil mastermind behind the deception is. For the far right, the villains are the socialists, communists, democrats, and such, led by the Pope of Rome, assisted by the Masonic Order, Satan, the Trilateral Commission, and Barack H. Obama. For me and some others on the left, the evil masterminds are instead the board of directors of the Fortune 500, plus their servants at the World Bank, the Pentagon, and whomever they have chosen to be president of the United States at the moment. Okay, I'll give the right credit for the Trilateral Commission. Good call there. Your list of scoundrels may vary. In the year 2000, a progressive thinker named Richard K. Moore published a nice essay titled Escaping the Matrix. Moore makes the Matrix movie a metaphor for the world today. For Moore, the evil masterminds of our world are the billionaire capitalist ownership class. Moore traces the changing relationships of the global economy, the nation-state, empire and imperialism, and the capitalists who now run the show. We heard the first half last week. Moore discussed how, in the past, the capitalist elite supported a strong, powerful state engaged in imperialism abroad. Imperialism enriched the capitalists at home at the expense of the colonized people on the periphery. The capitalists got much richer, and the citizens at the heart of the empire got a little more prosperous. But then the relationship of the powers began to change. By now, aided by neoliberal economic policies, the capitalist elite has gotten stronger than the state and is seeking to weaken the state further. Apart from the state's military, which the capitalist elite now controls. The several so-called free trade agreements are essentially laws that stop the state from doing anything that would interfere with the capitalists' corporate profits. The real imperial core now is no longer the nation-state, but the transnational capitalist elite themselves. The elite is now plundering the economy of what used to be the imperial core, the same way they had earlier plundered the economies of India and Africa. On to today's segment. Plundering the former core makes its citizens poorer and resentful, so the elite institutes ever more repressive measures to control the restless population. For example, neutralizing the Bill of Rights, and abolishing welfare and Social Security, and by fostering divisiveness at home. Divide and rule. Lynn Gary read the first half of Moore's essay last week. Here she is with part two of Richard K. Moore's essay from 2000, Escaping the Matrix.
Globalization and World Government. The essential bond between capitalism and nationalism was broken in 1945, but it took some time for elite planners to recognize this new condition and to begin bringing the world system into alignment with it. The strong Western nation-state had been the bulwark of capitalism for centuries, and initial post-war policies were based on the assumption that this would continue indefinitely. The Bretton Woods financial system, the IMF, World Bank, and a system of fixed exchange rates among major currencies was set up to stabilize national economies, and popular prosperity was encouraged to provide political stability. Neoliberalism in the U.S. and Britain represented the first serious break with this policy framework and brought the first visible signs of the fission of the nation-capital bond. The neoliberal project was economically profitable in the U.S. and Britain, and the public accepted the matrix economic mythology. Meanwhile, the integrated global economy gave rise to a new generation of transnational corporations, and corporate leaders began to realize that corporate growth was not dependent on a strong core nation state. Indeed, Western nations, with their environmental laws, consumer protection measures, and other forms of regulatory interference, were a burden on corporate growth. Having been successfully field-tested in the two oldest, quote-unquote, democracies, the neoliberal project moved onto the global stage. The Bretton Woods system of fixed rates of currency exchange was weakened, and the international financial system became destabilizing instead of stabilizing for national economies. The radical free trade project was launched, leading eventually to the World Trade Organization. The fission that had begun in 1945 was finally manifesting as an explosive change in the world system. The objective of neoliberal free trade treaties is to remove all political controls over domestic and international trade and commerce. Corporations have free rein to maximize profits, heedless of environmental consequences and safety risks. Instead of governments regulating corporations, the WTO now sets rules for governments, telling them what kind of beef they must import, whether or not they can ban asbestos, and what additives they must permit in petroleum products. So far, in every case where the WTO has been asked to review a health, safety, or environmental regulation, the regulation has been overturned. Most of the world has been turned into a periphery. The imperial core has boiled down to the capitalist elite themselves, represented by their bureaucratic, unrepresentative WTO world government. The burden of accelerated imperialism falls hardest outside the West, where loans are used as a lever by the IMF to compel debtor nations such as Rwanda and South Korea to accept suicidal, quote, reform packages. In the 1800s, genocide was employed to clear North America and Australia of their native populations, creating room for growth. Today, a similar program of genocide has apparently been unleashed against sub-Saharan Africa. The IMF destroys the economies. The CIA trains militias and stirs up tribal conflicts. And the West sells weapons to all sides. famine and genocidal civil wars are the predictable and inevitable result. Meanwhile, AIDS runs rampant while the WTO and the U.S. government use trade laws to prevent medicines from reaching the victims. As in the past, Western military force will be required to control the non-Western periphery and make adjustments to local political arrangements when considered necessary by elite planners. The Pentagon continues to provide the primary policing power, with NATO playing an ever-increasing role. Resentment against the West and against neoliberalism is growing in the Third World, and the frequency of military interventions is bound to increase. All of this needs to be made acceptable to Western minds, adding a new dimension to the Matrix. In the latest Matrix reality, the West is called the international community, whose goal is to serve humanitarian causes. Bill Clinton made it explicit with his Clinton Doctrine, in which, as quoted in the Washington Post, he solemnly promised, quote, "If somebody comes after innocent civilians and tries to kill them en masse because of their race, their ethnic background, or their religion, and it is within our power to stop it, we will stop it," close quote. This matrix fabrication is very effective indeed. Who opposes prevention of genocide? Only outside the matrix does one see that genocide is caused by the West in the first place, and that the worst cases of genocide are continuing, that assistance usually makes things worse, as in the Balkans, and that Clinton's handy doctrine enables him to intervene when and where he chooses, since dictators and the stirring of ethnic rivalries are standard tools in managing the periphery. A U.S. president can always find, quote, innocent civilians, wherever elite plans call for an intervention. In Matrix reality, globalization is not a project, but rather the inevitable result of beneficial market forces. Genocide in Africa is no fault of the West, but is due to ancient tribal rivalries. Every measure demanded by globalization is referred to as reform. The word is never used with irony. Democracy and reform are frequently used together, always leaving the subtle impression that one has something to do with the other. The illusion is presented that all economic boats are rising, and if yours isn't, it must be your own fault. You aren't competitive enough. Economic failures are explained away as temporary adjustments, or else the victim, as in South Korea or Russia, is blamed for not being sufficiently neoliberal. Investor confidence is referred to with the same awe and reverence that earlier societies might have expressed towards the will of the gods. The Western quality of life continues to decline, while the WTO establishes legal precedents ensuring that its authority will not be challenged when its decisions become more draconian. Things will get much worse in the West. This was anticipated in elite circles when the neoliberal project was still on the drawing board, as is illustrated in Samuel Huntington's The Crisis of Democracy report discussed earlier. The management of discontented societies. The post-war years, especially in the United States, were characterized by consensus politics. Most people shared a common understanding of how society worked and generally approved of how things were going. Prosperity was real, and the Matrix version of reality was reassuring. Most people believed in it. Those beliefs became a shared consensus, and the government could then carry out its plans as intended, responding to the programmed public will. The excess democracy of the 1960s and 1970s attacked this shared consensus from below, and neoliberal planners decided from above that ongoing consensus wasn't worth paying for. They accepted that segments of society would persist in disbelieving various parts of the matrix. Activism and protest were to be expected. new means of social control would be needed to deal with activist movements and with growing discontent, as neoliberalism gradually tightened the economic screws. Such means of control were identified and have since been largely implemented, particularly in the United States. In many ways, America sets the pace of globalization. Innovations can often be observed there before they occur elsewhere. This is particularly true in the case of social control techniques. The most obvious means of social control in a discontented society is a strong, semi-militarized police force. Most of the periphery had been managed by such means for centuries. This was obvious to elite planners in the West, was adopted as policy, and has now been largely implemented. Urban and suburban ghettos, where the adverse consequences of neoliberalism are currently most concentrated, have literally become occupied territories where police beatings and unjustified shootings are commonplace. So that the beefed-up police force could maintain control in conditions of mass unrest, elite planners also realized that much of the Bill of Rights would need to be neutralized. This is not surprising, given that the bill's authors had just lived through a revolution and were seeking to ensure that future generations would have the means to organize and overthrow any oppressive future government. Let me say that again. This is not surprising, given that the bill's authors had just lived through a revolution and were seeking to ensure that future generations would have the means to organize and overthrow any oppressive future government. The rights neutralization project has been largely implemented, as exemplified by armed midnight raids, outrageous search and seizure practices, overly broad conspiracy laws, wholesale invasion of privacy, massive incarceration, and the rise of prison slave labor. The Rubicon has been crossed. The techniques of oppression long common in the empire's periphery are being imported to the core. In The Matrix, the genre of the TV or movie police drama has served to create a reality in which rights are a joke, the accused are despicable sociopaths, and no criminal is ever brought to justice until some noble cop or prosecutor bends the rules a bit. Government officials bolster the construct by declaring wars on crime and drugs, and noble cops are fighting a war out there in the streets. And you can't win a war without using your enemy's dirty tricks. The CIA plays its role by managing the international drug trade and making sure that ghetto drug dealers are well supplied. In this way, the American public has been led to accept the means of its own suppression. The mechanisms of the police state are in place. They will be used when necessary, as we see in ghettos and skyrocketing prison populations, as we saw on the streets of Seattle and Washington, D.C. during recent anti-WTO demonstrations, and as is suggested by executive orders that enable the president to suspend the Constitution and declare martial law whenever he deems it necessary. But raw force is only the last line of defense for the elite regime. Neoliberal planners introduced more subtle defenses into the matrix. Looking at these will bring us back to our discussion of the left and right. Divide and rule is one of the oldest means of mass control, standard practice since at least the Roman Empire. This is applied at the level of modern imperialism, where each small nation competes with others for capital investments. Within societies, it works this way. If each social group can be convinced that some other group is the source of its discontent, then the population's energy will be spent in intergroup struggles. The regime can sit on the sidelines, intervening covertly to stir things up or guide them in desired directions. In this way, most discontent can be neutralized and force can be reserved for exceptional cases. In the prosperous post-war years, consensus politics served to manage the population. Under neoliberalism, programmed factionalism has become the frontline defense, the matrix version of divide and rule. The covert guiding of various social movements has proven to be one of the most effective means of programming factions and stirring them against one another. Fundamentalist religious movements have been particularly useful. They have been used not only within the U.S., but also to maximize divisiveness in the Middle East and for other purposes throughout the empire. The collective energy and dedication of true believers makes them a potent political weapon that movement leaders can readily aim where needed. In the U.S., that weapon has been used to promote censorship on the Internet, to attack the women's movement, to support repressive legislation, and generally to bolster the ranks of what is called in the Matrix the right wing. In the Matrix, the various factions believe that their competition with each other is the process that determines society's political agenda. Politicians want votes, and hence the biggest and best organized factions should have the most influence, and their agendas should get the most political attention. In reality, there is only one significant political agenda these days: the maximization of capital growth through the dismantling of society, the continuing implementation of neoliberalism, and the management of empire. Clinton's liberal rhetoric and his playing around with health care and gay rights are not the result of liberal pressure. They are rather the means by which Clinton is sold to liberal voters, so that he can proceed with real business, getting NAFTA through Congress, promoting the WTO, giving away the public airwaves, justifying military interventions, and so forth. Issues of genuine importance are never raised in campaign politics. This is a major glitch in the matrix for those who have eyes to see it. I repeat, issues of genuine importance are never raised in campaign politics. This is a major glitch in the matrix for those who have eyes to see it. I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000. Escaping the Matrix. The Matrix cannot fool all of the people all of the time. Under the onslaught of globalization, the glitches are becoming ever more difficult to conceal, as earlier with the Vietnam War. November's anti-establishment demonstrations in Seattle, the largest in decades, were aimed directly at globalization and the WTO. Even more important, Seattle saw the coming together of factions that the Matrix had programmed to fight one another, such as left-leaning environmentalists and socially conservative union members. Seattle represented the tip of an iceberg. A mass movement against globalization and elite rule is ready to ignite like a brush fire on a dry, scorching day. The establishment has been expecting such a movement and has a variety of defenses at its command, including those used effectively against the movements of the 1960s and 1970s. In order to prevail against what seems like overwhelming odds, the movement must escape entirely from the matrix, and it must bring the rest of society with it. As long as the matrix exists, humanity cannot be free. The whole truth must be faced. Globalization is centralized tyranny. Capitalism has outlasted its sell-by date. Matrix democracy is elite rule, and market forces are imperialism. Left and right are enemies only in the matrix. In reality, we are all in this together, and each of us has a contribution to make toward a better world. Marx may have failed as a social visionary, but he had capitalism figured out. It is based not on productivity or social benefit, but on the pursuit of capital growth through exploiting everything in its path. The job of elite planners is to create new spaces for capital to grow in. Competitive imperialism provided growth for centuries. Collective imperialism was invented when still more growth was needed, and then neoliberalism took over. Like a cancer, capitalism consumes its host and is never satisfied. The capital pool must always grow more and more forever, until the host dies, or capitalism, is replaced. The Matrix equates capitalism with free enterprise and defines centralized state planning socialism as the only alternative to capitalism. In reality, capitalism didn't amount to much of a force until the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution of the late 1700s, and we certainly cannot characterize all prior societies as socialist. Free enterprise, private property, commerce, banking, international trade, economic specialization, all of these had existed for millennia before capitalism. Capitalism claims credit for modern prosperity. The credit would be better given to developments in science and technology. Before capitalism, Western nations were generally run by aristocratic classes. The aristocratic attitude toward wealth focused on management and maintenance. With capitalism, the focus is always on growth and development. Whatever one has is but the seeds to build a still greater fortune. In fact, there are infinite alternatives to capitalism. And different societies can choose different systems, once they are free to do so. As Morpheus put it, outside the Matrix, everything is possible, and there are no limits. The Matrix defines democracy as competitive party politics, because that is a game wealthy elites have long since learned to corrupt and manipulate. Even in the days of the Roman Republic, the techniques were well understood. Real-world democracy is possible only if the people themselves participate in setting society's direction. An elected official can only truly represent a constituency after that constituency has worked out its positions, from the local to the global, on the issues of the day. For that to happen, the interests of different societal factions must be harmonized through interaction and discussion. Collaboration, not competition, is what leads to effective harmonization. In order for the movement to end elite rule and establish livable societies to succeed, it will need to evolve a democratic process and to use that process to develop a program of consensus reform that harmonizes the interests of its constituencies. In order to be politically victorious, it will need to reach out to all segments of society and become a majority movement. By such means, the democratic process of the movement can become the democratic process of a newly empowered civil society. There is no adequate theory of democracy at present, though there is much to be learned from history and from theory. The movement will need to develop a democratic process as it goes along, and that objective must be pursued as diligently as victory itself. Otherwise, some new tyranny will eventually replace the old.
Lynn Gurry with a beautiful reading of Richard K. Moore's 2000 essay, Escaping the Matrix. Lynn read it in 2002 on the radio show she produced, Unwelcome Guests. That's still in business under new management at unwelcomeguests.net. And we can be found at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening. Illegitimae non carborundum, and please come back again next week. Till then.